Accession number 29167, Reel 3.
It's all right, fine.
Sorry, you didn't feel too much behind, you see?
No. As I say, I was running to catch up, but I was constant. I mean, we all were. I mean, at least I say we all. Most of the people most of my colleagues were very keen not to be, because people were being taken off the course, you see, and that was threatening in a way, because you had to pass tests, you had to pass exams. Oh, I don't remember the exact nature of them, and you had these physical things like swimming and so on, and where I felt myself not so much disadvantaged, but certainly pretty weak. But people were prepared to help. I suppose they very much needed to have the output of these training colleges. I mean, the demand for junior officers in the Navy at that time must have been tremendous, which was my good fortune in a way. But eventually, and I don't remember too much else about the training school, there again I think one was just so busy at it that I don't remember particularly bad moments apart from the swimming, nor indeed particularly good moments. But it was a very good moment when, since I was still 19 at this stage, you couldn't become a sub-lieutenant RMVR until you were 19 and a half, so I became a midshipman. Instead of having a stripe on one sleeve, one had a patch on one's collar. In the case of RNVR, it was a red patch. The Royal Navy had a white patch. So that eventually I was made a midshipman RNVR, which was, in my book, a tremendous step. I mean, it feels more of a tremendous step now than it did at the time, even, you know. I still don't know how it happened, but I'm very grateful that it did, because it really did, I think, transform my life. So, what to do with Noble?
Yep. Just one thing. Do you remember any of that? To get an idea of what subjects, what areas you covered in this officer training course, what were they? I mean, you had the physical side, you mentioned the school.
Yes. Yes.
Mathematics, navigation.
So rudimentary navigation, ship handling. One actually went to sea in small craft and were given the opportunity to see how they handle them, and to give commands to one of your colleagues handling, you know, sort of port 15 and so on. It wasn't much. I don't think there was much about man management, which one would have thought would have, but I don't remember that very much. But you're quite right. There was navigation. I say rudimentary navigation. There was a certain amount of using a sextant and that sort of thing, but mainly it was dead reckoning and charts, chart symbols, and that, you know, because that again played a large part in one's life. But you know, I don't remember the detail. I don't remember the detail. I think there was a certain. Of course, there was also signalling. I think again rudimentary. I mean Morse code, that sort of thing, which is no longer used.
And semaphore, I imagine.
That's right, semaphore. Yes, that's fascinating, isn't it? And also using oldest lamps and things like that. Not because you were going to become a signalman, but because you needed to see how these things worked. And isn't that terrible? I can't remember really the detail of the course
that's
make up. But it certainly sped along.
So when you graduate, do you have any what we pass out?
Yeah.
When would that be?
This was very early in 1944, because, well, it was perhaps March or something like that, because I did a certain amount of training thereafter, a short time, of sort of post-graduation, if you like. I mean, I went, for example, to the Mull of Kintyre to get some work on anti-submarine warfare, ASDIC, and that sort of thing. But I don't think we did... I mean, anti-submarine warfare was pretty... featured fairly largely in that postgraduate training, because a lot of people would be doing that. Indeed, as even on minesweepers, we had anti-ASDIC, and we were could be used as in an anti-submarine role. But very shortly, certainly I think by April, I had been posted to HMS Gazelle, which was one of the so-called BAMs, British American minesweepers, or British, the Americans called them auxiliary minesweepers, because they were auxiliary to the fleet, because in English terms, auxiliary minesweeper meant auxiliary to the minesweeping service, which was trawlers and things like that. So I was posted to still as a midshipman, because so it was certainly before I became 19 and a half, which I would have been in June. Yes, it was no later than April 1944, I guess.
Just before D-Day, of course.
Yes, that's right. This was it.
I remember you saying.
This is when, and this is why I suppose they had such an urgent need for young officers.
Can we talk about then the BAM? It's a British system.
Yes, of course.
It's probably a lend-lease.
Well, yes, there were...
Sorry, we've lost your mic.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, not a problem. Often happens. People often get up and walk away with it still attached. There we go.
Yeah. Many of them were built...
Oh, no, we've lost it again.
Oh, sorry.
Actually, what the best thing to avoid... It's because this has dropped off.
If you just... I'll put that in a
that'll, that'll give it a bit of slack, so...
Yeah, let me do it.
Yeah, wherever it is.
Is that all right? Yeah, good. Thanks.
Actually, I'm trying to...
That better? Is that all right?
That's fine.
We got the balance all right. Oops, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
That they're interesting, the BAMs. They were built for the British Navy, but they were built in various American shipyards, Savannah particular, where that's where Gazelle was built. And this Gazelle was built in '43, in the middle of '43, I guess, something like that. And they were like fleet minesweepers, we would call them in English terminology. They had a complement, an American complement of 80, but an English complement of 100.
So they were quite big, these ships.
Oh yeah, oh yes, indeed.
In terms of dimensions, do you know? I mean, this can be fabulous,
I imagine. I'm sure I've got a note of it somewhere.
Anyway, it's really.
Yeah, but they. Oh yes, and they, as I say, they were built by the Americans for the British market, as it were, and so several. Flotillas were. I mean, I was in the 40th minesweeping flotilla. There was a 42nd, there was a 41st, and at one stage there was a 42nd. So you know there were I don't know 20 odd more. I don't know. Some of them had rather strange names. I'm Gazelle. It's quite a nice name, but one was called Fairy, which in English naval terminology is strange. Another was called Cynthia. Not very warlike, really. But anyhow, I was happy with Gazelle.
Were they steel or timber?
They were steel, yes, they were steel. Welded rather than riveted. So that they were, you know, they were, and they were powered by diesel electric. But they had, they were fitted with the three types of minesweeping gear. That was the Oropesa, which was the steel cables. There was the so-called double L, which was a double line of cable, not steel, but rubberized tube with electric wiring within, so they could pulse and deal with electric mines, magnetic mines. And there was another thing called, I don't know what the acronym stands for, it's just SA, which was a sort of hammer box which you lowered down the side of the ship, which produced a hammering, which also had an effect on certain mines.
Acoustic mines, I think.
Probably, that's it. That's a good word. Yes, that's it. I should have known that, but I so that, so they were, and they were quite well armoured. They had depth charges, you know. They could be used, as indeed they were, as a sort of, almost as a second-class destroyer escort type of thing. And that indeed was one of the functions that we were used for at certain stages. So we were in, I joined up the ship in Granton, Granton.
Which is where, sorry?
I think that's on the east coast of Scotland near Leith. Because I remember going into Edinburgh and having tea in McVitie's. As a midshipman, I was still a midshipman, you see. So it was April or May, I guess. And we were exercising, we were working up, because the Gazelle had only recently come across from the States, and they needed certain. I mean, for example, all the bunks had to be taken out because we slept in hammocks on the ratings, and so did I as a midshipman. I slept in a hammock. So that, there were certain electrical problems, it was felt that it was better not to interfere with the construction stateside, let them do as they would do it, and then do the conversions or the changes when we got our hands on them, And so it proved. They went to various places for these mine on the whole minor changes. They were they were very very efficient ships.
And being modern, were much more comfortable.
Oh yes, that's
anything
right.
You'd been used to before.
Indeed,
your
indeed.
Experience. Yeah.
Yep. And as I say, even though I slung my hammock, because I was. I won't say I was supernumerary, but I was an extra hand in terms of the officers, and so I had no cabin, but at least I could sling my hammock in the officers' cabin corridor, which didn't prevent everyone tipping me out of my hammock as they came on board drunk from an evening out, but nonetheless, it was luxury, of course, to me.
And go into the wardroom, I suppose.
Oh, yes, indeed. Oh, yes. You see, unlike large naval ships where there was a separate midshipman's wardroom, I was admitted into the... We had six officers, I think. So I was at the top table, you know, because there was only one table. but it was very... That, you know, it was a bewildering, because... Being on a small ship like that, and learning a new trade, as it were, I soon became the navigating officer of the ship. Not a highly qualified, because there is a in the Royal Navy you became a highly qualified navigating officer, but I was the navigating officer, faute de mieux, really.
because one of my colleagues was the gunnery officer, another was the first lieutenant, and so on. So that, this was a new and wonderful experience. It was uncomfortable in some regards, because a small ship a smallish ship is quite uncomfortable at sea. And as I say, initially, I didn't have a cabin, but that didn't seem to. I mean, at the age of 19, you're not too worried about that. And then, as I say, we had exercises, we worked up, and then we moved round to the west coast of Scotland in order to exercise in preparation for D-Day, where our role was to act as a screen to the large ships which were going to bombard the Normandy coast.
Of course, you knew nothing about this beforehand, did you? I mean, No. Did you imagine that this...
No. We knew that we were going to escort the Warspite down south. But I don't think... I assume the senior officer of the flotilla knew exactly what we were doing, but we were just busy sort of keeping station generally learning really about the ship, for one thing, you know, how it handled, and we were trading our sweeps and doing various things which most of us had not done much of, really.
Was there a regular naval officer in charge of the ship?
Yeah, the commanding officer, the skipper, was a lieutenant RN, who was the most appalling chap. I mean, I'm sure he was a very good seaman, but he felt that perhaps he ought to have been a lieutenant commander. But nonetheless, I'm sure he knew his job extremely well.
And if he was a lieutenant, he was quite a young man,
presumably. Yes, he was. Yes, quite a young man.
Late 20s?
Oh, I guess so. He seemed old to me, but he was a caricature of a regular naval officer, really. I won't say his name, because that would be unkind. But he was perfectly nice to me, but of course, all his other officers were RNVR, which meant that he felt he had to show that, he rightly, he knew what was going on, and that these people were clumsy amateurs. But there it is. I mean, he ran the ship as he felt best. And it didn't, I mean, it didn't, he was perfectly civil, but he was a bit sneering sometimes about the rest of us. I was made wine caterer for the mess, and therefore I was besieged by Saconian Speed representatives trying to sell me hooch and so on. And of course, hooch was extremely low priced, particularly gin.
Hooch being?
Well, I mean, I'm talking in general terms.
Alcohol of all kinds.
Yes, particularly gin, of course.
Not some Scottish potheen.
No, I'm sorry. Yes, I didn't choose my words very carefully there. No, I was thinking of booze, as it were, generally, particularly, as I say, spirit. I mean, gin was so inexpensive that it was cheaper than drinking mineral water. We had a reasonable cook. I had a steward who sort of looked after me, and he was a nice little chap. But I should never forgive him for one thing. We were. Do you mind if I just reminisce slightly?
Please,
this?
Please do. Absolutely.
We were during the once we we moved down or down the west coast of Scotland ahead of the Warspite and some other ships whose names I've forgotten. But Warspite was our special responsibility. And of course, when we got down down into the Atlantic, there was this 24-hour postponement of D-Day. So we just turned around, steamed out into the Atlantic for X hours and steamed back again. And the weather, although it had vastly improved in the Channel, was still very uncomfortable in the Atlantic. And I was on watch on the bridge, uncovered, of course, as all bridges were in those days. And I wanted a cup of coffee. So I rang down and said to this very nice young man, "Timmins, cup of coffee, please." He said, "All right, sir." And so he staggered up to the bridge with this, I mean, instead of just a mug, it was a cup with a saucer and that sort of thing. And he had put milk and sugar into it for me. That's all. But unfortunately, instead of black coffee, he didn't realise that it was a cup of Bovril. And so he had put sugar and milk into a cup of Bovril, which really got me as near being sick as I've ever been, I think. But he was apologetic, and I didn't mind a lot, but it was filthy, and I've never been able to face Bovril since, really, even without milk and sugar. I mentioned that because here I had a wardroom, and I had a steward who looked after me. I mean, what a change in lifestyle.
And this is practically, what, a year? You joined up in 43?
Yes, that's right.
More or less. That's
why I say it transformed my life, really.
I can imagine, yeah.
I mean, that sounds rather sort of trivial, but it was a very distinct lifestyle change, as you can imagine. Then we lined up to get into the area, I think it was called Piccadilly Circus, an area south of the Isle of Wight where everyone gathered.
Sorry, and I just want to, I should have asked you this before,
yeah.
Because this, I know, is what they're interested in, the Imperial War Museum.
Yep, yep.
The actual practicalities of minesweeping, I know this is all very rushed, this warming up period. What's it called? Not warming up.
Working up. Yep. Yeah.
What do you remember of the different? You mentioned the three systems that you had on the ship. What do you remember of the way that they were used, and in what kind of formations you were meant to use them? Does any of that register or stay?
Not in great detail. I remember. I mean, we used all three systems in various ways. I suppose it was depending upon the information we had about the minefield that we were sweeping. My memory is that we relied a great deal. I mean, the problem about the wire sweeps is that they depended upon electric winches and things like that. And if, as sometimes happened, the winch failed, you had this enormous problem of hauling these things on by hand. I mean, it was all hands, not to the pumps, but to the sweeps. And then you had to sort of stow them and so on. And that aspect of it, I was being the navigator. I was on the bridge doing other things, but so I didn't have to get my hands dirty and cut with these. But it was an enormous task if something went wrong. I'm not saying it went wrong very often, but I remember that as a feature. The sweep that I remember we used particularly was the one for magnetic mines, which is this double tail of rubberized wire, which we streamed out to pulse, to ignite magnetic mines. The ones that we cut with the wires, we had to try and sink by shooting at them with sort of elephant guns, that sort of thing.
With elephant guns?
Well, you know, I think that's what they're called. I mean, I don't know. This is what I remember. I mean, they fire, presumably, a fairly heavy bullet. I remember on one occasion, this is later, after D-Day, we were sweeping between Iceland and Greenland, and we raised a mine, and we fired at it, just couldn't sink it. But finally, we did. But I remember people with these huge elephant guns. I didn't fire because they weren't, you know, it wasn't my job. But so that the magnetic, I seem to remember the magnetic mine as being one of the great threats at the time. Later, when we were doing what I call more routine sweeping, after the war, in fact, because there were still so many minefields lying about, that we were trying to be systematically to clear these things, particularly over towards Denmark. The Danes were so grateful that they sent Laura a pack of bacon and butter and things like that. But however, that's another matter. So we used all these three systems.
So you had the hammer box, you had the electrical charge system.
Yes.
And what was the one with the name?
The Oropesa.
The Oropesa. Was that the...
That was the sweep wire, wire.
How would that not... You wouldn't tow it behind the ship. It's got to be sort of surely...
Yeah, it...
Did it have a hydro...
It had on the end of it a sort of buoy system which drew it away from the ship, and there was a particular speed that you had to maintain, and one of the problems was that particularly in the English Channel immediately after D-Day, there were so many ships that it was not always easy to maintain that speed, and you had the danger, which happened to the Gazelle, in fact, that if you lost speed, if you lost too much speed, the thing just fell and could get tangled around the screw. But of course, I have to say that benefited me because we had to crawl back to Devonport to be repaired, or rather to get this thing sorted out, because we had some minor damage as well. And it was there that I met Laura in July 1944. So, you know, it's an ill wind that blows nobody any good.
No, that's fine. I think so the Oropesa is
the wire that cuts.
The wire that cuts. The one that which detonates the magnetic mines was the
pulse. The
double L system.
Yeah.
And the other one was the SA.
SA. I don't know what that means.
Which is this hammer
something box. Acoustic, I guess. Yeah, you hit that word.
Mines.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Shall we go on then to, let's see what we're doing. How are you doing? Are you okay? You don't need a break?
Yep.
It's coming up to 12?
No, fine, yes.
Fine, good.
Yes. Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm absolutely. I'll just do another. I'll just do this. This is Ernest Noble, Reel 4.
Right, so.
That's right, yeah. So now we're in Piccadilly Circus, which you said, if you're joining
us. It's a sort of assembly point. And then we.
What was the HMS Warspite? She was a...
A warship.
A warship.
A battleship.
She was one of the.
One of the sort of majestic, floating, gun carriers, yeah. Really. We then followed down a channel 10, I think it was, which went down to the easternmost beach, which is Sword.